Do you think people really get what's going on when they've fired up? I know there were some hiccups and so on, the Large Hadron Collider. I mean, this is kind of in your area, certainly. Mm-hmm. I mean, what is the pressing need to, I mean, could you give a simple answer about why we need to know what's anything smaller than quarks? I'm just being...
Why we need to know. Yeah. Well, it's the next step in the quest, which started with Newton, who gave its first unification by telling us that the force that holds this cup on the ground and makes the apple fall is the same as the force that holds the moon and planets in their orbit. And then we had unifications from Faraday and Maxwell, electricity and magnetism, and then we've gone on from there, Einstein, modern physics. So it's the next step in that quest. It's a quest which now involves elaborate machines and therefore is done on a global scale. But it's a continuation of what one strand of science, which is pursued for the same reason as all other fundamental science, because in the long run, science is the basis of all technology in unpredictable ways. So I think it is just something which we pursue in the same way as we pursue other sciences, and it just happens to be a science that has to be pursued by everyone pooling resources to make one huge instrument, rather than lots of people working in parallel using smaller instruments separately.
I suppose the point...
So I don't think there's anything qualitatively different about the motive for the quest.
Yeah, the question I was making was that there's certainly a tendency now to use this phrase translational, that science should have applications.
Absolutely, yes.
So that the notion of the usual joke made about the space program and nonstick pans, frying pans. There's obviously, you believe that there's a larger and more, should we say, noble vision involved here than just pragmatic applications.
Well, I think there's no conflict because I think if we look back at the intellectual history that's led to the important advances, then we will see that they lie in discoveries which were not motivated by anything other than curiosity. Well, here sitting in Crick's house, let's think of a double helix. When that was discovered, there was no conception of what the applications might be 50 years later. When the laser was invented,
absolutely,
there was no conception that it would be used not only for weapons but for DVD discs and detached retina operations, etc. And so all we know from history is that science is the basis for technology, but in unpredictable ways. And the origins of any technology stem from a whole lot of independent bits of science discovered maybe 20 or even 50 years before, linked together in unpredictable ways. And so I think that's the reason why it's often a mistake to direct science too narrowly. I mean, certainly in Britain at the moment, there is a long debate going on about the way we assess the impact of science, and most of us argue that you can't really assess the impact of a particular piece of research over a 5-year time span, but nonetheless, if you look over a long time span and consider a field of science broadly, then you can assess the impact. And so I would say that although what motivates scientists is probably just intellectual interest, they rightly believe that they are serving society best by doing that, rather than by necessarily focusing on some more immediate narrow application. Well, to give another example, a cure of cancer. I mean, Nixon's war against cancer. Was premature because people didn't know how to focus on cancer. What the right thing to do then was simply to understand more about cells and genetics and all that, and that may still be true. So the way you are going to tackle cancer is through better fundamental understanding.
Yeah, I was thinking to the...
And those who do that sort of science obviously are motivated by wanting to understand nature in a fundamental way, but they also genuinely believe that what they are doing is probably the best way of leading towards really important practical outcomes.
Yeah. The history of science has tended to become much more of a large industry. Mm-hmm. The Royal obviously began almost as a club.
Mm-hmm.
You have Hooke and von Leeuwenhoek, mm-hmm. looking through a microscope, right, yes, yes. Hooke coming out with his book. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I suppose one has to think of how extraordinary it must have been to actually be seeing these incredibly magnified
amazing.
Yep, parts yep, of insects yep,
yes,
and so on.
Yes,
so on.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And then let's fast forward to something that has a parallel here. This is also the 60th anniversary year of the foundation of the National Science Foundation. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That came out of suggestions from committees
with Vannevar Bush
run by Vannevar Bush,
yes,
indeed,
yes,
and James Conant, yes, president of Harvard. Yes. Mm-hmm, but they kind of did this without much oversight. If you look back at the history, it was this sort of, we've got a problem here, we're going to solve it, and here we're going to... And there was a certain autocracy about doing this. So you see where I'm going with this. The more committees and so on, the more difficult it sometimes is to move forward with this exploring the name of books of Bush's thing, Science, the Endless Frontier. Funding, how do you do the funding and get that right? Do you have large governmental organizations or do you do what the Howard Hughes Medical Institute has just done and what the, I gather from Mark Walport, the Wellcome is going to do, which is to fund the scientists and let them just explore. So these are basic fundamental philosophical issues here.
Well, again, I think it's a matter of horses for courses. I mean, some science can still be done by an individual investigator or a small group. Some requires at least access to very major facilities, whether it's a synchrotron or a particle accelerator or such like. But I think it would be a pity if there was no frontier science that could be done by an individual or a small group. I think we're far from that. I mean, I would say that there is a problem in something like the LHC. I mean, I wouldn't advise a young scientist necessarily to go and work in one of the groups at the LHC, because there you get the disadvantages of industrial work without the benefits, because you're part of a very large team. But that's exceptional in science. Even if, say, in astronomy, people use a very big telescope, they can do their own program on it, or in a small group, they can get a few nights on a telescope and do their own thing. And so it's still possible for an individual to have an idea and see it through. I think there is a trade-off between funding projects and funding people, which agencies like the NSF and Wellcome Trust have to optimise as best they can.
I was just thinking about something like the LMB, the Laboratory of Molecular Biology at Cambridge, which had obviously Perutz and Crick Sidney Brenner in there. And if you read some of Sidney's stories about this, I mean, I know he's being slightly funny, but it's, you know, we get up in the morning, then it was time for the coffee break, and then we talked a bit more, and then it was time for lunch, and then talked a bit more, and it was time for tea. So there was this very convivial atmosphere discovery going on, not massive throughput, no output kind of thing, what he would now talk about. As these things become much larger to crunch in terms of data, it does tend to get more industrial, as you were saying.
Well, each subject does, but I think there are always fields of that style. I mean, for instance, Rutherford wouldn't have enjoyed working at CERN, for instance, because he liked doing the subject there, and Sidney Brenner may not have wanted to work on the human genome sequencing, etc. But there are always new subjects starting.
Yes.
We can say what they were, where that style of thinking is appropriate, but any subject, as it develops, tends obviously to involve more elaborate instrumentation of various kinds.
So you would still sell science as a career to anybody, would you?
I mean. Oh, absolutely, and because it's developing fast, and I think the key thing is if you go into science, you don't have to be cleverer than the previous guys. You have to have access to facilities they didn't have. And computers, for instance, you can do computer simulations now, which are completely inconceivable 10 years ago, and make important new insights and new discoveries. And that's a consequence of Moore's law. And to go back to genetics, the speed of genome sequencing has increased by a factor of 1,000,000. In the last 10 years. You know, it's down to $1,000 or so per genome. And so that's the most amazing development. And so people who go into science now, they're not constrained to solve the problems the old guys got stuck on. they can do completely new problems that the previous generation never had a chance to do. And the frontier is ever more extensive. So I think the opportunities are still greater. But I think a young scientist has to pick his or her subjects according to what their tastes are. They may want to work in a group, they may want to do lots of computer simulations, they may want to do precise experiments, they may want to do more speculative or synthetic thinking, but they can always find a subject to match their tastes.
Did you ever think of doing anything other than science? Is there anything else that was a great passion of yours that might have seduced you off into something else?
Well, I thought of doing economics, and had I been an economist, I might not have been an academic at all. And I was always interested in the design of ships or architecture and things like that. So I could have imagined myself doing other things. I wasn't someone who had a definite vector form from earliest youth that I wanted to be a scientist.
Yeah. What about the arts? I
was put to the piano as a child and manifested zero talent, although I still enjoy bashing out the piano when I can and listening to music incessantly. I had no talent there. Although, you know, if I could choose my talents, I think I'd choose a composer above everything else, even a scientist.
There is that distinction, isn't there? This goes back to Snow and the Two Cultures, mm-hmm. which was another anniversary mm-hmm. last year.
Yes.
And it's the obvious comment that people make, which is that had there not been a fill-in-the-blank, somebody else in science would have found it
Absolutely.
Out two
yeah,
years
yeah.
later, four years later, mm-hmm. six
yes,
years
yes.
later. Whereas, had there not been a Beethoven, duh.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think much about the act of creativity in I think I remember reading something that you'd written about.
Yes.
Maybe one of those John Brotman Edge essays.
That contrast is a real one. That if A didn't make a scientific discovery, then B will. Few people make an individual impact. I mean, Einstein is especially admired because he probably made discoveries that would have taken several decades before someone else had done them, whereas in most cases, like... double helix, it would have come within a year or two, maybe not so neatly, but it would have come fairly quickly from someone else. Scientists don't feel they make a distinctive contribution. But on the other hand, they have a compensation, because if you're an artist and you're not all that great, your work has individuality, but it doesn't last. Whereas if you're a scientist and you're not that great, then your work still lasts. You produce a few bricks in the edifice of public knowledge, which are durable. So scientists lose individuality in their work, but they feel they're doing something which is lasting and durable. But there is this contrast, and I always liked the way Peter Medawar put it. He said, when Wagner took 10 years off in the middle of the Ring cycle to compose Götterdämmerung and Tristan, he wasn't worried... Sorry, I've got the wrong way around. When he took 10 years off in the middle of the Ring cycle to compose Meistersinger and Tristan, he wasn't worried that someone would scoop him on Götterdämmerung, because obviously your work is individual. Obviously a scientist if Crick had dropped out for 10 years, someone else would have discovered the double helix.
Piece here in the Times, core, and the headline again, you didn't write, God, the Universe and Me. Do you remember this piece?
I don't actually know.
So let me ask you then personally how you find a resonance in these various issues, because you talk about multiverses and so on in numerous of your books. I mean,
well, the multiverse is one of the ideas I've helped to propagandize. The idea
exactly
that physical reality is much more extensive than the region we can see through our telescopes.
And I thought I came across a couple of essays in the you know, the John Brotman annual question thing.
Yes,
one
yes.
of the things were. You know, what have you changed your mind about, or I don't remember the exact questions here, but there was certainly some sense where you were raising the issue of, well, you know, maybe there's other big bangs. I mean, maybe we're being too cosmically parochial here.
No, that's the multiverse idea. Yes,
right.
The idea that the volume we can observe with our telescopes is a tiny fraction, even of the aftermath of our Big Bang. In that it may go on more and more. Most people will believe that the universe is hugely more extensive than what we can see. But the next step is that perhaps There's not just the aftermath of our Big Bang, but many other Big Bangs. And this is an idea which is still speculative, but it's suspected to be true by many people. And I hope that within the next 10 or 20 years, it'll be either refuted or put on a firmer footing. But this is, I think, one of the important speculations in cosmology. Just as when I was starting research 40 years ago, the whole idea of the Big Bang was speculative.
What kind of evidence would persuade you that there were, in fact, that the multiverse theory was a fact, not a speculation? Mm-hmm.
Well, it would be indirect evidence, which would, I think, come about if we had a better understanding of the physics pertaining to the very early stage of the Big Bang. At the moment, we can trace things back to the first microsecond after the Big Bang, because the physics that we can infer was relevant then can be tested in the lab. But right back at the beginning, of course, conditions were so extreme that we don't have a reliable theory. But we may have a theory that does unify gravity and particle physics, if we have such a theory, then we'd be able to test it in a number of ways in the lab or in astronomy. And if we apply that theory to the Big Bang, it may tell us that our Big Bang is one of many. So the idea of the multiverse may be a consequence of a theory that's testable in other ways. It isn't yet, but it may be.
All right, suppose...
And so it's speculative science and not just metaphysics for that reason.
But suppose that happened,
yes.
You know, and you were then faced with that evidence. Because
yes.
I often ask people this question at the Beyond Belief meeting, for example. Mm-hmm. Sean Carroll was there, David Alberts and so on. I often ask them the question, okay, well, you know Spinoza's idea of Deus sua natura, behaving... subspecie eternitatis, mm-hmm. as if you're under the aspect of eternity, mm-hmm. that everything is interconnected, mm-hmm. and then make a little leap and go to John Stuart Bell and talk about entanglement, mm-hmm. and Bohm's ideas, mm-hmm. and so on, and say, well, does this change the way you would treat people? Would this change your perspective vis-a-vis other members of humanity if you know that we're all interconnected ultimately in this fashion? Is that too far and speculative for you, or do you see the resonance there?
I don't see that resonance. I mean, I think the question of the nature of physical reality and understanding the bedrock nature of space and time is one of the challenges to science. When we can settle that question, we will know much better whether our Big Bang was the only one, whether there are other domains of space and time separate from ours, whether there were many Big Bangs, whether there's another universe, as it were, alongside ours, both embedded in some fourth spatial dimension. There are all these ideas which are now speculative. We might put some of them on a firm footing. And that would just be a further extension in our concept of the hugeness of physical reality. But I would see that as just one step beyond what's happened ever since Copernicus, because we had the idea of our solar system being essentially the universe and the stars just being a vault of heaven. Then we had the idea that the stars were other suns, and then we had the idea that our galaxy was just one of zillions of others, and now we have the idea that the cosmos seen through our telescopes may be a tiny part. So I don't see anything qualitatively different about the extent of space, but it may change our view about the fundamental laws of nature. What we think of as the fundamental laws of nature may be, in a sense, environmental accidents in some still grander context, and there may be a deeper level where the laws are universal. So I think we are going to have a different concept of reality, but how that will affect our view of each other is a separate question. It seems to me that our relation to each other is obviously intimate, since we all originate from the same spark of life 4 billion years ago through cosmic evolution. I don't think these broader concepts of the physical universe have very much effect. But I think there is one respect in which being an astronomer does have an effect on how we see human beings, and that's that it allows us to see ourselves as part of an ongoing process. Most educated people are aware that we are the outcome of 4 billion years of evolution. But they tend to feel that we are the culmination, that's it. Whereas as an astronomer, I know that the sun is less than halfway through its life, and the universe may have an infinite future. And to quote Woody Allen, eternity is very long, especially towards the end, and lots could happen then. And so in that perspective, we may be not even the halfway stage in evolution. And so post-human evolution, either organic or maybe in silicon-based computers, could go far beyond that. And so and this may already have happened in other parts of the cosmos. There may be entities far beyond human beings in ways we can't possibly conceive. And so I think astronomers do have an open-mindedness about the possibility of a far more wonderful level of complexity, even more complex than human beings, somewhere out there and in our own long-term future. So that's a sense in which I think you get a special conceptual view of humanity by thinking of cosmology, because it allows us to think of a long-range future as well as a long-range past. And in that context, it raises another thing which I worry about and is the theme of my next book, which is are there limits to science set by what our brains can cope with? There may be things that we can't understand, maybe even the fundamental theory of space and time, simply because our brains aren't up to it. Just as a chimpanzee can't understand quantum theory. There's no reason whatever to believe that our brains, which evolved a few hundred thousand years ago to cope with life on the African savannah and all that, should be matched to understanding the deepest aspects of reality. I think it's rather remarkable that we've got so far in understanding the cosmos and the quantum. But there may be aspects of reality that we just can't grasp. Computers may help us in some respects, but again, it seems to me there's no reason whatever to think that our brains are attuned to all aspects of reality and science. So although science is an open frontier, there's far, far further to go. There may be some aspects of science which we can't conceive of yet and which may be beyond our understanding.
So you don't think of the discoveries of science as being a series of demotions in our place in existence. I mean, you're suggesting that we should perhaps ramp up our cosmic modesty, I think is a phrase of yours, isn't it?
Yes. Well, I mean, that depends on if there's life out there, you see. I mean, of course, the SETI program, Looking for Intelligent Life, of course, is a program I strongly support, although I think one can't rate any odds on success because we don't understand how life began here on Earth. And that's a well-posed scientific problem. And until we understand that, we can't assess how likely it is to have got started elsewhere. And even if simple life got started, we don't know how inevitable it is that it evolved like life did here. So we've no idea how complicated life might be elsewhere. But it would obviously affect our perspective. We'd seem less lonely if we found extraterrestrial intelligence out there. On the other hand, as you say, it would allow us to be less cosmically modest if intelligent life is unique to the Earth. The extra slant I would then put on that is that that would not mean that life was a tiny irrelevance in the vast cosmos, because even if it's like that now, then there is this huge future ahead of us when life could spread from the Earth and far beyond.
I noticed on the agenda for the AAAS meeting that there was, in fact, some sort of a celebration of the SETI program, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence.
50 years since Frank Drake's first paper, yeah.
Frank Drake still cosmically extant, as I understand it?
Indeed. In fact, we had a two-day meeting at the Royal Society just last month on SETI and its social impact, as it were, and he was there, yes.
Right, and this is very much associated as well with Carl Sagan.
Indeed, yes.
Communication of science.
Yes.
And I also noticed that there was a section on the origins of life, Jeffrey Bader, and of course some of the early experiments were done at Salk and UCSD with Stanley Miller, Leslie Orgel, Jerry Joyce now continues the RNA world sort of thing.
Yes, so, yes.
Wouldn't you think we'd have sorted this out by now? I mean, all the other things that have been discovered, that the origins of life, I mean,
well,
aren't you a bit surprised that we haven't got
I am
that
slightly
nailed?
Surprised. well, what I'm slightly surprised there's been so little work on it, because there aren't many other important branch of science where everyone still quotes a 50-year-old experiment in the way that the Miller experiment is still quoted.
Right.
So it does surprise me that so little work has been done. But I think it just illustrates an important feature of science, which is that if you're a scientist, then the right methodology is not to work necessarily on the most important problem. It's to work on the most important problem, which is tractable now. And therefore, you have to perhaps turn away from problems which you don't feel are ripe for solution, because there's no one gets, in fact, to quote Medawar again, those who fail to solve problems beyond their competence get at best the kind of contempt reserved for utopian politicians. And so it may be that the origin of life is a problem which wasn't ripe for solution. But there are some interesting ideas now, and I would certainly hope that there is progress on that in the next decade or two, and that's important in its own right for sort of filling one of the missing steps in Darwinism. But of course it's even more important to astronomers, because if we knew the origin of life on Earth, that would give us clues as to how likely it would be to start elsewhere, and of course where best to look.
Yeah, you quote Sir Peter Medawar, in fact, who turns up with the same frequency as Lewis Thomas as a source
Indeed.
Of great quotes about
yes,
science.
Yes.
But the point that he was getting at there about is almost from his book The Art of the Soluble.
Mm-hmm.
It's knowing what problems to go
Absolutely.
After. And Francis
yes.
Crick used to say the same sort of thing. General philosophy of science here for advice to a young investigator
mm-hmm.
is really, it boils down to knowing what problem to pick, doesn't it?
Well, to pick a bite-sized problem. And I think going back to Francis Crick, as we know, beyond the age of 60, he turned towards consciousness in the brain. and this is a sort of Everest problem in science. He knew that he would never reach the summit. He embarked on the quest, and I think it's appropriate that he should, having consolidated reputation. But I think he wouldn't advise a young scientist who'd achieved nothing to embark straight away on an almost insoluble quest. But it's rather noble that a scientist who'd got great achievements in the past would continue to work hard on this even greater challenge. But I think the key thing for a young scientist is to pick a problem which isn't trivial, but is nonetheless bite-sized and tractable. And that's part of the knack of being a good scientist, to actually choose the most challenging problem which you can solve.
Yeah. Let's go back to something you said earlier. There was a book that came out some years ago by John Horgan, who's now at Stevens College, and it was called The End of Science.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. It almost sounded as though you were saying there that you thought there might be some cognitive closure, some sort of barrier, where we can't grok what's out there.
Well, I think there might be in some areas. There might be some topics where the subject's open-ended, not just because we haven't reached the frontier, but because we've reached the limit of what human brains can grasp. Mm-hmm. But I thought that his book was deeply misleading, because it did imply that all the big challenges had been solved. Mm-hmm. And I think a better metaphor for science is as a frontier which is advancing, and as it advances, the periphery gets longer. So more new questions come into focus with each advance. So I see science as a quest where the number of fundamental problems is expanding rather than eventually being worked out and contracting. Mm. But nonetheless, there may be some problems which we can't formulate and can't even conceive yet.
Where do you see the Royal Society going from this anniversary point?
Mm-hmm. Well, the Royal Society is, of course, a society which covers the whole of science and tries to support scientific excellence across the field. It's more international than it was, because its membership is international, and it engages with other academies to deal with problems like climate change, etc. But it's also more involved in giving advice to governments and other bodies, because there's more need for expert advice than there was. And so the rhetoric of Obama in his inaugural address is universal, really, that science needs to be in its rightful place, and its rightful place is to be an input into many of the most important decisions that have to be made. So an academy like the Royal Society is involved in promoting excellence in science, promoting discussion of science, publication of the best science, quality control of science, and also promoting science education and outreach, and also ensuring that decisions and public understanding are based on the best evidence, and that we try and impose quality control wherever we can on the scientific evidence.
Yeah. So the rightful place is what is standing at the shoulder of politicians delivering rational evidence.
Well, that's one of the that's one rightful place, but also I see ourselves as continuing a quest which goes back to before Newton, and also, of course, being part of our culture, because Darwin's work didn't really have direct applications, but is nonetheless regarded as an important part of human culture. And I think that is true of much of science. Even if there were no applications of a double helix, it would still be a wonderful thing to know that life had this amazing unity.
Yeah, a couple of points there. One would be the onward and changing nature of many of these things. Even Darwinian natural selection, mm-hmm. you know, there are critiques now, but good ones being mm-hmm. made about, you know, trends in epigenetics and mm-hmm. so on and so mm-hmm. forth. So it changes. It's a moving target mm-hmm. in that mm-hmm. sense. The second thing is that I nevertheless, as I look back on these subjects, and I sometimes irritate people by this, by pointing out the personalities that drove areas of science. Mm-hmm. And I think about the Hookes and the Newtons mm-hmm. and the Darwins and so on. Mm-hmm. And people say, no, you shouldn't do that. Talk about these figures. The mm-hmm. science is this large entity, you know, mm-hmm. where individuals don't count that much. But there, plainly, this I think there's a way of engaging an audience out there. And I'm just asking your thoughts mm-hmm. on this. Is in fact to celebrate some of these figures,
yes. mm.
and with all their quirks and oddities and mm. so on, because they were something like Hook was a real character. For
Absolutely,
example.
Yes. Mm.
And what's your take mm. on that?
Well, first, science is a work in progress, as it were. So, Darwinism is being modified and evolved and understood in a deeper sense as time goes on. And to take Darwin as an example, I mean, he was a personality about whom one wants to know so much, because his life and his work were so intertwined, and that is true of the other great figures in science. So I think biographies of scientists are sometimes very dull, but not always. And also the role of the individuals is important in that they may have an influence on others and thereby give an impetus to the subject, because although anything that a scientist discovers would have been discovered by someone else, that would have happened differently mm-hmm. If a particular individual personality hadn't given it the impetus. But I think, having said that, most scientific discoveries happen at a time when the appropriate technology came into play and couldn't have happened much earlier. There are a few exceptions to this. I mean, one exception I would give to that is sociobiology, which we associate with E.O. Wilson's right. controversial book in the 70s. There's no reason whatever why J.B.S. Haldane couldn't have written that book. He had this famous aphorism that he would give his life for two brothers or eight cousins, etc. There's no particular reason why that subject couldn't have happened in the 20s and not in the 70s. But that's a rare exception. In most cases, the subject develops when a technology became available. That's been true in most of astronomy, for instance. A new telescope's come online, and that's allowed a new type of observation. A new type of analysis has come online. Gene sequencing became possible, etc. But there are some exceptions, and I think sociobiology is one example where it didn't depend on any special equipment. It just depended on some personality taking it up and making it part of the serious agenda of science.
So you mentioned Newton, but suppose I said to you, okay, you can dinner party. Mm. This is the dinner party question.
Yes,
you
yes.
can have a dinner party now. You know, six, eight people. Who would,
yes, yes.
Who would you like to have at your dinner party?
Well, I would not have Newton. Yes,
because he would spoil it for everybody else.
Despite seeing him as the number one intellect of the millennium, but I would have obvious contemporaries. I would have Galileo, because I think Galileo. From his writings, was obviously a a man of a certain humour as well, so I think I would have him of that period, and I would have Darwin and Maxwell, and I would have had Francis Crick, certainly.
Yeah, great. As you've gone through your career, are there any points at which you had a big learn? Usually this is something goes wrong, and then you discover that why it went wrong. And this is sometimes mm-hmm. interesting, I find, out to younger scientists as they're going along.
Yes.
Setbacks is a learning experience. Do you recall anything like this in your career?
Not in a big way, but that's simply because my work has been rather piecemeal. I mean, I haven't invested many years in one single project. I've tended to work on phenomenology, trying to interpret data, doing a lot of sort of modest things in an incremental way, working in parallel on three or four different subfields of astronomy. And so as time's gone on, I've dropped one area and focused on the other, but no very sudden transition. And therefore, I've had no particular emotional investment in any particular part of my work. Whereas I know other people in science, particularly those who've invested years in building a piece of equipment or something, who clearly have a tremendous emotional investment in the work, and frankly would not have pursued it if they had not had a rather exaggerated hope of its importance, because that's what motivated them. So there are people for whom it is shattering if their work is refuted, whereas I've adopted, in a sense, a low-risk strategy of working on a broad front, because I tend to have a short attention span anyway, and so I've enjoyed working on different topics, following a fairly broad range of topics in parallel rather than in series, as it were.
Yeah, I'm wondering, I mean, what is your sense of the various aspects of this huge field right now? I mean, there's the meeting Origins at ASU, Arizona mm-hmm. State University,
yes.
last year.
I was really sad not to be at that.
I know, and a lot of great mm-hmm. people there, yeah, that you yes. know perfectly well, yes, including yes. your doctoral student at one point, Roger Blanford. Or
yes, yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. All these topics, you know, dark matter, mm-hmm. a new book by Louisa Gilder on the age of entanglement, which in fact does go back mm-hmm. to John Stuart Bell stuff,
yes,
and so
yes,
on.
Yes.
Brains, BRANES, yes, associated yes. with Lisa Randall, for
yes,
example.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
The dark matter issue. Where do you see? Is there any sense of how these things are shaking down, as to put it that way?
Well, I think the wonderful thing about the subject is there are these quite separate areas of interest, mm-hmm. and I think I would highlight three different frontier areas in the general field of astronomy. One is planets around other stars. 15 years ago, we had no idea of whether there were planets orbiting other stars, whereas now we've got good reason to think that many, indeed even most stars like the Sun, may have planets orbiting them. And this is a very exciting branch of the subject, and the quest is to find planets like the Earth around other stars. And then, of course, to ask the question, is there a biosphere in any of them? So this is a subject which didn't exist 15 years ago. It's developed through advancing technology. Incidentally, this has not involved huge consortia. The pioneering work was done by individuals or very small groups using modest-sized telescopes. Yeah. But this is a very exciting area in studying astronomy in our own galaxy,
right.
which makes the... makes the universe much, much more interesting. If you look up at the sky, and each star we now think of as not just a point of light, but as the Sun with a group of planets around it, and within 20 years we know the properties of those planets just like we know the properties of the planets orbiting our Earth. So that's a really exciting, rapidly developing new subject. So that's one. The second area is what I'd call extreme phenomena. This is places where we see in the universe things happening which are far more extreme than we can simulate in the lab. Immense concentrations of energy, powerful jets, things moving close to the speed of light, strong gravity and black holes, etc. So we're understanding more and more about that. And then there's the broader question of cosmology. And here these are of two kinds. There's the kind which I mainly do, which is to try and understand in more detail how from a simple Big Bang the complex structures of our universe emerged. How did the first galaxies and stars form? When did that happen? how can we learn about it by observations? But then the other more speculative area is the one you've alluded to of brains and all that. This is the question of the unknown physics, which pertains at far higher energies than we could achieve in the LHC, and which therefore pertained at the very, very early stage of the Big Bang, where every particle had those huge energies. And this is where the physics is very uncertain, and where there are all these ideas, string theory and all that, about extra dimensions. Most people suspect that the most fundamental laws of nature will involve the idea that space itself, which we think of as just a sort of amorphous, boring vacuum, has some sort of grainy structure on a tiny, tiny scale, just like this table has an atomic structure. But the scale on which space has its structure is a trillion, trillion times smaller than an atom. The good reason for believing it's on that sort of scale, and therefore far, far away from any direct experiments. But when the entire universe was squeezed down to that size, then, of course, the physics of the entire universe was determined by these phenomena. And that's why we won't understand the very early stage of the Big Bang, why the Big Bang exploded, whether there were many Big Bangs, etc., until we have this unification of the very large and the very small. So that is a frontier of science which is relevant to understanding the Big Bang better. But I think it's important to emphasize that that is a very fundamental branch of science. But none of the rest of science depends on it. I mean, a lot of people who work on those subjects are sort of rather hubristic. They think that's the most fundamental, important science. But it doesn't affect any of the rest of science, in that if you're a chemist or biologist, your work's held up because things are very complicated, not because you don't understand what's happening deep inside the atomic nucleus. And if you're an ecologist or something, that's even more true. And so the sciences aren't like a building where you have, particle physics on the ground floor, then chemistry, then cell biology, then organisms, right up to economists in the penthouse, as it were. It's not like that.
Economists?
It's not like a building where shaky foundations impair what's on top, because each science has its own irreducible concepts. And the problems of biology are solved in a biological context, and what happens at the subnuclear scale is irrelevant to them.
Well, except that one could make the claim, certainly, perhaps you didn't not mean this, that your economists up in the penthouse,
yes,
given all the global uproar economically recently, had they, one wonders if they had known more about the cognitive neuroscience involved in decision-making under uncertainty, whether they would have made different decisions. I don't know.
Oh, no, I agree with that, because they need to realize that economic man is not the same as a real man. They need to know that. But it would not have helped them to understand more about subnuclear physics.
Right, right. So in terms of practical applications, let's think about international relations, because you talked about that earlier. Mm-hmm. I had a conversation at the Santa Fe Institute a few months ago with Chris Llewellyn Smith, mm-hmm. who is putting together this organization called
Sesame.
A project which would unify, would bring together scientists from, frankly, warring nations.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Do you think that's a good idea?
I think it's a wonderful idea, but I think it exemplifies the way in which scientists have been able to bridge political divides. We started about the history of the Royal Society, where it was international right from the start, with Oldenburg, a German, being the first secretary. Humphrey Davy was allowed to travel freely in France during the Napoleonic Wars. And during the depth of the Cold War, there were still links between Soviet scientists and their Western counterparts through the Pugwash movement, for instance. This is another example where groups of scientists from nations that could not get together on a political level can share the common culture which science provides and the common goals of meeting the world's practical problems. So I think this is just another example of how science is intrinsically global and intrinsically a feature we all share, irrespective of our national politics and of our faith.
Yeah. So let me ask you, what are you optimistic about?
I'm optimistic that the internet in particular has hugely expanded the number of people who can participate in science and scientific debates. And so this, together with the huge expansion of intellectual capital in Asia, is going to give a tremendous impetus to the scientific endeavour and technical innovation. So I think far more people have the ability to participate in science and creativity of this kind. And the key challenge is to organise this politically so that the obvious downsides and risks of disruption from dissident minorities can be controlled. But I think there's every reason to be optimistic about these rapidly developing areas of science, huge developments in computers and in genetics. And we've got to cope with the challenges these pose, ethical challenges and political challenges. So I think we can be very, very optimistic indeed about the speed of these challenges.
So you have about six more months to run as president of the Royal Society.
Nine more months, yes.
Nine more months. Oh, yes, through to the end of November.
It is my last year.
Right, your last year. Mm-hmm. Does that mean that you're suddenly going to have a lot of free time, or have you already started planning what to do with it?
It's been a very interesting involvement, and this year, the anniversary year, has involved quite a lot of extra activities. For instance, last month we hosted the heads of nearly 100 academies from around the world in London for their plenary meeting and had a meeting on biodiversity. We've got a series of meetings on the key challenges to science, aging, climate, biodiversity, etc., during the rest of the year, and various other events. So it's going to be a busy and fascinating year. Next year I will catch up on my science and also on travelling, because although I've done some travelling, I've not been able to go to as many conferences as I'd like to, and so I hope to catch up and accept more invitations than I have been able to this year.
Well, we'll be, as you know, we're doing building part of the Science Network's Agora or public square.
Yes,
is actually on diet, aging, nutrition, metabolism, one of the subjects we're doing. So we, in fact, hope to come and see Linda Partridge in May for her Royal Society meeting.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Good.
And
yes, because that is one of our grand challenge discussion meetings on aging. Yes.
But I mean, this is another huge topic, though, of course.
Absolutely.
Isn't it? I mean, aging population. I was talking to Colin Blakemore about this, and
absolutely,
he was making the point that...
Yes. And of course, the key thing is, of course, how long we remain active and whether these last years are spent in a dependent state or an active state. But I think we can hope for a gradual extension. But of course, here in California, there are those who are impatient and want to... live forever, aren't there? There's like Ray Kurzweil,
right?
Hopes to live forever. In fact, I was interviewed by something called the Californian Society for the Abolition of Involuntary Death, which is one of those organizations which freezes people.
Right.
I think the cut price. Yes, the cut price thing is they freeze just your head; otherwise, they freeze your whole body. And I was interviewed by them. And I upset them because I said I'd rather end my days in an English churchyard than a Californian refrigerator. And they thought this was a very backward-looking concept.
So the other thing that I noticed happened that the Royal did this year, and this is a California engagement, Fred Kavli, whose foundation's up in Santa Barbara, bought you a new building, apparently. So what's the plan for that?
That's right. We've been able, largely due to a generous benefaction from Fred Kavli's foundation, to buy a rather beautiful country house, which we're converting at the moment. And it'll be a sort of conference centre for meetings on science and science policy, etc. It'll accommodate residentially about 45 or 50 people, in very pleasant surroundings. It's an analogue to one or two other similar places in the UK. There's a place called Ditchley, which is a centre for Anglo-American policy studies. Our Foreign Office has a place called Wilton Park. But this will be a place as a flagship for studying international science and its applications. And so this is one new development for the Royal Society, and it's a nice coincidence that that's happening during our anniversary year. It'll be opening for business in the summer.
So this international spreading is very much your flagship issue.
Well, I think it's very important, and also an expansion of our policy endeavours, because we feel it's very important to articulate the policy implications of science in as clear a way as possible. And the Society has been doing this over the years, but I think not with the priority which the challenge demands, and we're working harder on that now.
Yeah. At the various ageing meetings that I've been to, I keep reminding people and reading passages from some of the work that was done by Francis Bacon, who was thinking about this with elaborate detail and exploring issues of longevity in the late 1500s, early 1600s. And I also noticed that one of your predecessors as the Astronomer Royal, Edmund Halley, who has a comet named after
him,
wrote a paper in the Phil Trans
about the population,
an estimate
of London,
of the degrees of mortality of mankind.
Yes, that's right.
So these people were really polymathic, as you pointed out.
Indeed, they were
interested in everything.
Yes.
So I'm delighted that with that beginning, the Royal Society is thriving, and thank you so much for your stewardship of it these past 5 years.
Well, thank you very much for the conversation.
It's been fun. Good. Martin Rees, thanks very much.
Okay.